You are Locked On Knicks, your daily podcast on the New York Knicks. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Shot blocked. Porzingis with his fourth projection. Courtney Lee for three. Beasley lines up. Ntilikina.
What he does is contagious. Because of infectious.
And across the lane. Baker launches. Jack to Porzingis. Fires up the ball.
Welcome, everybody, to Locked On Knicks, the podcast that's in the 99th percentile of explaining, complaining, and entertaining. I'm your host, James Bacino, a.k.a. Def Jam Gundy. You know me as NBA Injury Report on Twitter. And this is episode 333. We're halfway to the mark of the beast. On today's episode, we're handing out our final report card. This one is for none other than Kristaps Porzingis. We're joined today by Drew Steele, a.k.a. Scooter Toots on Twitter, also known from his work at Posting and Toasting and Nylon Calculus. And we're going to talk about the 2017-18 season of Kristaps Porzingis. Before we do that, 929-377-5103. 929-377-5103. Call me up. Leave a voicemail. We'll get to it on a voicemail bag. All right, that's it. Let's start the show. Hit it, Mark.
Yes.
So I'd like to begin by contextualizing the environment in which we are grading young Kristaps Porzingis. Now, before we get started, I just want to say quickly that, yes, it's fair to factor in his injury. It was a major injury, which brings with it major question marks for at least the next couple seasons, but I would argue the rest of his career. And surely, yes, that does factor into what we look at when we look at last season for Kristaps. But more importantly for me and for this exercise, I am looking at it as the age 22 season of a potential franchise player. So I'm looking at it as the first season where he's the clear-cut number one guy. You know, it's his first season without Melo, hogging all the touches. And as such, I'm trying to evaluate, more than anything, his potential in this role as the number one guy. He's still in what I would like to call the prospect phase, I'm using air quotes now, of his career, in which, in my opinion, his ceiling has not been fully established. And when I say that, I mean, for most of these guys, you know, there's exceptions to every rule, but eventually you get to a point in your career in which you more or less are what you are. And, you know, maybe you can fine-tune some stuff. The more, dramatic changes you might see later on in a career would be, you know, maybe working on your long-distance shot, maybe adding some moves, maybe establishing more of a post-game, that kind of thing. But you do get to a point when you're kind of like, we know basically what this player is. And in my mind, KP is not yet fully established in this regard. So we're looking for signs still of what he can become. You know, if he is going to be a franchise player, which is what I think most of us hope he can become, in my opinion, that does not have to happen in the first year of him being the focal point of both the offense and the defense. But I think he does have to show certain signs, and he has to demonstrate that he has, let's say, the clay that's of the proper caliber for sculpting into a number one type guy. So the question for this past year, in my mind, is what kind of clay are we working with here with young Kristaps? Does it project forward as the kind of clay out of which you can sculpt a franchise player on a championship caliber team? I know I just said a lot before you even got your first word in there, Drew, but do you have any problems with this context in which I'm trying to set this year in review? What do you think about what I just said?
No, I don't think I have any problems with it, because I think that's kind of how you have to evaluate it, is that, you know, this was the first season. He was the guy. There's no Melo. He's getting all the touches. So, like, how did he do in that role as the first year? And then you got to look, and that's basically how you have to look at it. Then you have to determine, is this something you can work with moving forward? Yes. Like, is anything sustainable? Is this the norm? Is this what it's going to be here on out. So yeah, this would be the best way, because year three is almost like the year where like you kind of get an idea of who the player is going to become in their prime.
Yeah,
like you need to give a player at least like 3 years to kind of figure things out. That's why, like I'm not worried about like rookies, like their first year, even their second year.
Right.
It's just kind of like, all right, they're still figuring things out. That's why it was always like, just be patient with Porzingis. But I think now after year three, we can be, I would say we can take the kids' gloves off a little more.
Yes.
So we can be a little more critical, but at the same time, like, you know, not be over at the top and be like, oh, he's going to be, you know, a bum or something like that. But like, we don't need to go that far. Right. But like, we could be more critical than, yeah, you know, than like year two. Like,
yes.
Year two, you're like, oh, he fouls too much. Well, you know, defense takes a while. Like, you just have to see. Like, yes, that is just the example. We'll probably get into this defense later, but like something like that. So you need that third year to see it. So.
Yeah, and you know, you want to see progress on both sides of the ball, but I do think it's also, you know, like he's being expected to be a number one guy. Not everyone is. So that in itself could, you know, should take a little bit more time than, you know, coming into your own as a backup power forward, and that's all you're going to be, or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
So it's year three, but he also came in, you know, he came in young. He wasn't Frank young, but he was 20 when he started. He was 22 this past year. And this was, like we said, the first year without Melo, the first year of being the primary option on offense. That's what I want to kind of look at first when we talk about, does he have the right clay? To use, you know, just the most brilliant metaphor ever that no one's ever thought of when talking about a young athlete, this concept of clay.
Yeah, no one thought that.
It's completely unique. And I would like to begin by looking on the bright side of things offensively. What do we see from him on that side of the ball, year one, primary option that we liked?
So what we saw, we almost saw like a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde version of Porzingis this year. Because the first, I'd say like about like 2 months or so, like, you know, like October, November, maybe not too much in December, but like those first 2 months, he was just you know, insane. Averaging tons of points. He was making all of his like mid-range shots. He was like, he had like a couple of, I think, 30-point games.
Yeah.
Or so.
He actually had, I have stats on that, 8 of his first 11 games, he scored 30 points, including his first 40-point game in that stretch against Indiana. And one of those 3 games where he missed 30, he scored 28. So basically 9 of his first 11, but you get the picture. He came out on a tear.
Yeah, and it's like you see that player and you go, that's the framework for a franchise, first option, you know, regular playoff team. I don't know championship level, because like, I feel like for someone like Porzingis, you have to craft a specific team around him, kind of like you did with like Dirk that 1 year. But you saw someone like a, you know, an easily, you know, tough champ, you know, a tough playoff team, like a consistent, you know, like 50-win team.
I think that's
like
fair.
That. Like you kind of you, right? Like that's what you saw in Porzingis, like those first, I would say, what, 20 games or so, and you're just like, that's the guy. We like, it's like the Knicks did it. They have the guy.
So
and then like after that, it was just like, I don't want to say it went downhill, but it, you know, it went downhill pretty hard.
Oh, for sure.
Before the injury.
No. I agree completely. To sort of add a little bit of color to that take, the way I look at this and sort of the progression of his career, it's, you know, first year is the number one option. Let's say that for the 9th time of this podcast. And so the first thing that you have to do as a number one option is to at least be someone who you can't leave alone, or he's going to cook you. Like, you got to be someone who the other team has to game plan for, and you got to draw a ton of attention. Now, I think on that level, he passes with flying colors. He's the kind of guy, if you leave him alone, he's going to punish you. He's going to demand a double team. One interesting stat, which is not at all like the first one I would say proves this, but I just kind of found it fun as I was going across some of the like cleaning the glass stats. He was in the 98th percentile in drawing non-shooting fouls. And I thought this was interesting, and I think it kind of went to show that he had a lot more problems his first 2 years, just sort of establishing his position in the post. You know, he was working on his core strength, his lower body strength, and I think there is still work there to go. I think he actually got worse as the year went on, and that's one of the cons we'll talk about, is I think his stamina over the course of a season needs work. But at least in the beginning, he showed a lot of progress in just kind of being a load, being someone who's difficult to, you know, to knock off his spot. I think he did a much better job at showing he can punish the little guy on a switch. using his height well to shoot over, you know, smaller guys when they're switched on to him. Now, I think that he relied too much on his post game after he found a lot of early success there and just kind of shooting over the top of people, and more on that in a bit. But I do think it was good to see that he's got that in his toolkit of, like, this guy is can't deal with me. I can shoot over him. I think one of the things he needs to kind of add on top of that is to be more of a bully. But he did, at least in the beginning, do a much better job of holding a position in the post. And I just want to say that, you know, we skip forward to sometimes then, and we'll talk about this, his trouble of dealing with double teams. But there are many people who just that first part of it, that can't be said for. And I do think it does take a special sort of talent to command that double team almost every time down the floor. And I think that Kristaps has shown that he at least has that ability, which is not all the way there in terms of being the kind of guy that you build a championship team around. But he showed something that was a question mark going into this past season in a way that's very positive. And just kind of like rounding out what I really liked about his offensive performance, talking about, you know, this idea of him being a unicorn and a unique talent. He did shoot 40% from downtown. Just a fantastic number on a pretty high volume. That was 82nd percentile for bigs. And that includes like power forwards and stretch forward type people who, you know, are expected to shoot a little bit more than most centers, which is where I would like to see him play more. But I'm pretty sure it's in the 100 billionth percentile for 7'3" rim protecting monsters. So excellent news there that Kristaps shot 40% from downtown. And talking about modern shot chart type shit, 23% of his shots came from three, which is in the 61st percentile for bigs. So some good news there. Am I missing anything in terms of what he did well offensively, or should we move on to kind of how he struggled there?
Before we get to the struggling part, I think we need to know, like, during those that first 2 month stretch where he was making all of his like mid-range shots, like those are the shots that teams are going to give up and allow, and any successful team has players who make those tough shots and those inefficient shots efficiently.
Right.
So and we saw the, you know, the year-to-year growth between year two and year three of Porzingis being able to, if you switch a lower guy, he now has almost figured out how to shoot over them. So, like, you know, when a shot is difficult to come by, and if he can, like, improve his efficiency from the mid-range, I mean, he, you know, according to Clean the Glass, off his mid-range, he shot 42%. That's the 60th percentile. So if he can bump that up closer to, like, the 50 range, you know, the high 40s, you know, ideally, like, 50%, then that's, like, a huge advantage for the Knicks moving forward, where you just need a bucket. And you just throw it to, you know, 15 feet, you know, mid post, and he'll get you that shot.
Right.
So that's like something you could build upon moving forward. He needs, like you mentioned, he needs to do better passing out of the like double team from there, and he needs to, you know, fight a little more through contact, because there are a lot of times he would get like hit or fouled on last shots, and the refs just weren't calling it.
Yeah.
Because you just saw he had like some like wonky shot, and then you could see the replay and that. Defender would like touch his elbow and stuff. He needs to do a better job of like trying to fight through that, because he's not always going to get the call, even though it's annoying to watch. It's a clear foul, but he's not always going to get it. So he needs to fight through that contact more. But at least we saw a glimpse of, all right, he can make that tough mid-range shot, which is, it's not ideal. You don't want him taking them, but he's going to have to take them at some point. So yeah, I just wanted to, you know, build upon that a little more.
For sure. No, those are all good points. I do want to kind of expand on some of the things we said that he struggled with this past season offensively. But before we do that, just want to remind you guys that you are listening to Locked On Knicks, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. So let's talk about how he struggled a little bit offensively. We mentioned he did struggle to pass out of the double team. Once he established that that was something that, you know, teams needed to do to deal with him, which is great. The next step, obviously, is orchestrating the offense a little bit. And this is something where, so far, we haven't seen that he's capable of doing. I do think that he has some decent vision. I think throughout his career, we've seen examples of him making some pretty slick passes. But the fact of the matter is, He hasn't done it on any sort of volume that gives you the feeling so far that that's in his repertoire. I think he can add that. I do. But the numbers don't really back me up there in his first season. His assist to usage rate, and he had pretty much like a 98th percentile usage rate because, like we said, he was establishing himself as the number one guy. But his assist to usage rate, how many times he generated an assist given how many times he finished a possession, was in the first percentile. To give you an idea of how infrequently he was successfully passing out of double teams. So when you look at him, Drew, where do you... I think you're a little bit more pessimistic about his ability to become even, let's say, an average passer in that situation, because right now he's among the league worst. So what are your... What do you think about this and his future in this area?
Yes, I'm pretty skeptical of it because, you know, if you don't show... Like, he didn't really show much. Like, every now and then he had a good pass, but so did, like, Enes Kanter every now and then had a good pass. So it's kind of difficult to be like, so he just really didn't read the floor well.
No.
And trying to read the floor well is very difficult to become just average at. So for Porzingis with his passing, it's really difficult to tell. Not difficult to tell, it's going to be really difficult to see if he's actually going to improve the even average. So my HPPR stat, which is an improvement on the assist-to-turnover ratio, has him in the fifth percentile of all players at a negative 6.18, which is second worst on the team behind Michael Beasley. Like, even Enes Kanter had a better HPPR than Porzingis. Like, this is, like, the ability to read double teams and make the correct pass is really, really difficult.
Yeah, like,
he's in the fifth percentile, so him jumping to, like, the 50th, that means, you know, that's a 45, it's not really a 45% improvement, but you get what I'm trying to say, like, he's jumping up that many percentiles.
Yes.
Just to get to, you know, zero, you know, point one. So I don't know if that's ever going to get there.
And this is in many ways, I mean, this is sort of the crux if he can be the guy, right, who's going to, like, lead you to a championship, I should say.
Well, yes, I would say yes and no, because the yes would be, the crux of it would be that he can create his own shot and he can create for others, right? And he doesn't need that other person to help out. But you could build the right team around him where he may not be the best person to pass out of a double team when he's in, like, the, you know, the high post. But if you give him, like, another great scorer to help out with him, or a great point guard or something along those lines, you can make the team out where you can actually, you know, not... You can deal with that weakness. You can minimize it to an extent.
That's fair. I mean, and obviously his defense, which we'll get to, goes a long way toward making it less important that he create for others because of how valuable he is on that side of the ball. But it definitely, if you're talking about the kind of player who's like, this is a guy, no matter who I throw on there, like, I can construct a championship team around them. Not no matter who I throw on there, but I can construct a championship team around them in, like, six different ways. Maybe if he doesn't ever learn to get better passing out of the double, it's, like, you know, down to two to pull, you know, these numbers out of my ass completely. But yeah, it makes it more difficult. I have a little bit more hope. I think it's something that is very difficult to learn. I give him a little bit more leeway because it was his first time on an NBA level being the main guy like that. But it's fair to point out that he was very bad at it in the time that we saw. So it's a matter of how much you believe. And I mean, some people would say that when you're that kind of, like, historically bad, so to speak, at a statistic, that it doesn't look very likely that you're going to improve that much. And I think that's fair also.
Yeah, that's my main issue with someone like Emmanuel Mudiay and even like a Trey Burke. Like, when you're historically bad at a statistic, for example, like defensive RPM, and I don't like using, like, the RPMs, like those adjusted plus minuses to be the end all be all. But, like, if you're, like, you know, 500 out of 500 players for, like, multiple years in a row, like, if you're in that bottom 10 multiple years in a row, I highly doubt you're ever going to even get to, like, average at that statistic. Like, that's kind of how I feel. Like, Porzingis last year was, you know, like, the fifth percentile in HPPR. Him getting to 50% would be extraordinary.
Right.
And if you don't, you know, if you want to be more on James's side, that's fine. Go ahead and have that. But if you don't necessarily believe me, I would read Ben Folt's article if it's publicly available. I don't know if you put it behind the paywall, but he did a great article on Porzingis, and he kind of highlighted similar to what I was saying, like when you're historically bad, like Carmelo Anthony level bad at something, like with passing out of double teams and like creating those things, it's really difficult to become just that.
I think what you need to do is reckon with the fact that when you talk about something that's statistically likely, like that is real. That's, you know, we can't ignore it. So to say that Kristaps is going to become average in this regard, you have to think, you have to recognize and acknowledge that it would be really bucking the odds in a huge way. I would just say that that does happen sometimes, and maybe it's because I'm a Knicks fan, but I do think that there's a better chance than the odds would suggest. But the only thing I have to really back that up is just sort of like intangible, non-quantified stuff, and you have to sort of admit that, you know, from his production so far, it's a stretch to say he's going to get there, which I recognize, but I believe in my boy, so I think it's possible. I want to talk now about sort of his mid-range game a little bit more. He was a mid-range monster, for better and worse. 58% of his shots came from mid-range, 28% of them came from long mid-range. Both of those numbers are in the upper 90s when you're talking about percentiles. I would say, though, I think at least part of that, if we're looking for reasons, you know, to think that he can improve upon how frequently he shoots from there, I do think part of that was coaching. I think Jeff Hornacek refused to run interesting plays for him after it became clear that he was sort of like taking too many of these contested, double-teamed mid-range shots. You know, some of that's on him. Like, of course, Kristaps, he's the guy out there. He's the guy shooting. But I felt like it took him struggling like this for like 2 months before Horny decided, hey, maybe we should run this guy off some screens instead of just dumping a hit into him in the high post, like possession after possession after possession. And, you know, when you look at his coaching style, to pile on Hornacek a little bit more, like, he sat Frank for every tiny infraction that he was real or imagined, but he never seemed to discipline KP for, like, taking bad mid-range shots. I would argue you should let them, you know, fight through things a little bit more, but I didn't even see him kind of barking at him sometimes when these things were happening, and it made you wonder how much of this was part of, like, the shitty offense that he designed. You know, I can't put it all on Horny, but I do think that contributed to us seeing more of these shots than we would like to.
Well, this may be the first time I'm going to be even harder on Hornacek than you are, and even though, like, we're both hard on him, but I think as a good portion, I would say the majority of it was the Knicks' offense. Like, you even look at like Porzingis' percentage, like shot attempts at the rim, he was in the 7th percentile. Yeah. Like, they didn't run things for him at the rim. They couldn't run things at the rim because Enes Kanter was clogging.
So, like, there's, thank so, you. Like, thank you.
Right, there's that aspect of it. Like, that's one part. Like, he just kind of clogged the lane.
I want to, like, I want to double underline this because I also had this same stat written in my notes, but I think it's really important that sometimes, like, stats without context, obviously, don't tell you the whole story. Once again, 18% of his shots were at the rim, which was 7th percentile. And you're like, he's like a soft Euro. He's not a man going into the hole. But when you watch these games, as Drew and I did, game after game, you'd saw so much of that was, once again, Enes Kanter's lumbering ass, clogging the lane, getting ready for offensive rebounds before a shot even went up. Like, pick and roll wasn't even an option. And when it was, they didn't run nearly enough of them, first of all. And when they did, a lot of times the spacing was just all messed up because of someone like Enes Kanter. So I thought that was a really interesting way that, you know, stats lie sometimes or don't tell the full story. So I wanted to kind of, yeah, just double underline.
Yeah,
that. But
yeah, I wouldn't say stats lie.
I know you would never say like, stats lie, but
yeah, I would never say, it's just more of like you need to further investigate why is it at 18%, and it's because Enes Kanter's clogging the lane. And then you ask, like, then the solution would be you want Porzingis closer to the rim. Mm-hmm. So how do you get Porzingis closer to the rim? You don't play him with Enes Kanter. You play him with someone like Kyle O'Quinn, who can actually operate from like the high post.
Yes.
Because he can hit an open mid-range shot if you leave him open, and he can pass to cutters. So like just by that virtue, O'Quinn provides more spacing, even though he doesn't shoot three-pointers.
Yeah.
Whereas Enes Kanter doesn't shoot mid-range shots, he doesn't pass, and he just kind of clogs the lane. So that's one big part. And that's a combination of like roster construction and also the offense with Hornacek. Because when you watch the Knicks, they ran Because I thought just when Hornacek was hired, they were going to use Porzingis like a souped-up version of how they used Channing Frye in Phoenix. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, oh, it's great. They're going to run pick and pops. They'll run some rolls every now and then because, you know, the spacing that Channing Frye, you know, from Porzingis to Channing Frye would create from three and that gravity. Never ran it. Granted, you know, they had Goran Dragic running the point, and, you know, it was Jared Jack and Frank Ntilikina, sure. And then Derrick Rose before that. So I understand to a degree, but they never did that. And instead, Hornacek used Porzingis more of like, was it Marquise or Marcus on the Suns? I don't know. One of the Morai.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Like, they just used him in, like, because Hornacek used him more as like the mid-range player, kind of like operate how like Carmelo operated the year before with the Knicks. Mm-hmm. So all Hornacek did was basically say, all right, you know, Chris Epps, you're going to be the mid-range guy. We're just going to post you up high post. Go do your thing. And that's basically what the Knicks offense for the most part was. And the only time they ran like a more designed play, it would be, you know, bring it to the strong side, bring it back to the weak side, and that weak side action was posting up Porzingis. Like, it was just, there was no creativity.
No, whatsoever. You could, you know, and you could like squint and try to convince yourself, like that meme of Jimmy Butler looking at a piece of paper, that like, oh, maybe they're just running way too much high post offense to give him reps. And there's like something to be said for that, but when that's the only thing you ever do, it's like, no, you need to have more variety. And there was something lacking in coaching there. Again, like, he's young. He did need to establish that part of his game, but not to the exclusion of everything else, you know?
Yeah, now that isn't to say he didn't jack up bad shots, because
he did.
He did jack up bad shots, and he took, like, you know, he would take some bad threes. He would take some bad contested shots. I get that, but,
yeah,
you know, he took so many mid-range shots. Like, you can't just help, like, why is he taking so many? Yeah. Is it the offense or is it the player? And from what we've seen with, you know, Hornacek, both, even like for some aspects of Phoenix, you know, in this 2 year, was it 2 years with the Knicks now? I don't even remember.
It felt like a lifetime, but it was only 1 year. No, it was 2 years. It was 2 years. You're right. Sorry. My bad.
It's all right. Like as you said, it felt like he's been here for like 5 years. But like that was the offense. It was, you know, either Horns, where they had the two post guy, you know, the two big men at the high post, and then Enes Kanter eventually like leaked down low. Or it was some sort of other action, whether it was like a flex action or even like some pseudo. They didn't really run the triangle anymore, but some like pseudo triangle action. They get like weak side, a two-man game, but the two-man game was just post Porzingis up. Like, it was just a nightmare. So I'm hoping that when he comes back, Fizdale has kind of told everyone, like, stop taking mid-range shots, start taking some more threes and more shots at the rim. So I'm hoping I'm hoping Fizdale will improve that, but
there,
I don't think that's really going to improve, though, until like Kanter gets out of here.
There is so much riding on the first few weeks of the season in terms of what kind of coach Fizdale is going to be, because they can say all the right things, but, and I tend to believe them, but until I see it in action on the court, you know, it's kind of like put your money where your mouth is. But I want to finish up with, I've got one last sort of like pet peeve offensive problem that KP has. Now, we started by talking about passing out double teams. I think that's the most sort of serious problem he has in this side of the court. Then we talked about mid-range. I'm less concerned about that. I'm the least concerned about this, although it definitely needs to be fixed because it's piss poor, in my opinion. And that's his screening ability.
Good. We're on the same page. I was going to say, if you don't say this, I have to mention this if you don't, because it's a disaster.
It's infuriating. I think, did he honestly set more than, like, and I'm not even trying to be sarcastic for the sake of being humorous here, but like five solid screens, like, you know, like nice hard screens all season, you know?
I honestly couldn't even tell you. I'm trying to see where you can find,
because I watched all these games, and when he set a good screen, like, I was like, yes, yes, Kristaps, you know, clapping for him. And I think it happened like four times all season.
he slips all of them. I wish I knew where you can find the screen stat.
Yeah.
So I remember there was a screen stat with like Russell Westbrook where like he only set like two. Was it like the entire season? Like something ridiculous. Like Russell Westbrook doesn't set screens. So like I would love to know where that is, because Porzingis, like, he technically sets them, but he slips every single one.
Yeah.
And the defender knows it. So like the pick and pop and the pick roll like didn't matter. And then you have like Jared Jack, who, you know, he he tries his hardest. We love him. You know, we want to max him, but
yeah,
God bless him. He wasn't the same player as he was before all his knee injuries. Neil Aquino struggled. So, like, it was like a combination of, like, not the best guard play and then Porzingis not setting screens. So it was like you can't even use a pick and pop because, like, they didn't even run it well.
Yeah.
It was just one of the most infuriating things. And Porzingis was a big part of it, too, because he didn't even chip him. He didn't even touch that.
I agree. And it's especially frustrating because that's potentially – he could be such a weapon, like even more of an offensive weapon if he sets a good screen because he's such an outside shooting threat that if he gets good at screening, you know, it'll turn that pick and roll and that pick and pop, like you said, into a much stronger weapon because they'll have to respect him more. They can't – you know, they won't be able to, you know, drop their coverage and just like, you know, KP's barely going to screen. He's going to try and slip it. And they'll have to be more aggressive with him, and that's going to open things up. But with his weak-ass screens, I mean, I don't think this is something – I know he's got a higher center of gravity, and that does factor into it. Like, you know, you can't get as low to sort of block someone like an offensive lineman or whatever. But I still think that's a pretty flimsy excuse. And I think with the right coaching, someone who's actually getting in his face about this, it can be improved greatly. Do you agree? Do you think he's a lost cause with his screening?
No, I don't think he's a lost cause. I mean, it wasn't just a Porzingis problem. It was like a team problem.
Yeah. You didn't see a lot
Enes Kanter wasn't good at screening, despite being, you know, like, you know, the big tough guy. He wasn't good at screening.
He was very slightly better, like very slightly.
Yeah. Kyle O'Quinn, I don't think, ever rolled to the basket. And, like, I don't remember. I think, like, I don't know the stats. I'm pretty sure O'Quinn maybe rolled, like, 5 times to the basket. He always, like, pops out for a mid-range shot
His
screens. And the best screener on the team is probably Noah, but, you know, Noah's not on the team.
We don't talk about him.
Yeah, like, there was Hernan Gomez, but he's not on the team anymore either. But, like, Noah can't shoot or score or lay up or dunk or anything like that. So, like, his screens are almost useless. But, like, he was the best screener on the team. So, like, it's just, like, a team problem.
Yeah. Maybe Ron Baker. Maybe the most underrated player in the history of the league.
Yeah, I don't even know who the best screener on the team, like, you know, who actually played.
Right.
Like, because Noah didn't play, I don't even know who set the best screens on the team. Like, I couldn't even tell you.
Did Timmy try to set some screens? Feels like something he might do.
I hope the listeners will reach out to us to tell us where we can find screen stats, because we clearly both have no idea. I would love to know if Tim Hardaway actually set a screen this season, because I don't think he did.
I want to move on to something which I don't even really want to talk about, but we have to because it's part of his year in review. I want to talk about the torn ACL. Before we do that, just want to remind you guys that you're listening to Locked On Knicks, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. All right, so the torn ACL. How much should this factor into his grade for this year? How much does this affect his future? Do we just give him an F for being a weak little Euro bitch? Is he injury prone? What does this mean? What do you make of this?
Well, I'm not factoring in it for the season, so I'm just going to grade him on, he played 48 games or so, or 40 games, so I'm just going to evaluate him on the 48 games.
Samesies.
But, however, this is a concern in terms of, like, injury concerns, being injury prone, and moving forward for his actual, you know, will he actually achieve his true ceiling?
Yes.
Because, like, I don't think he's completed a full season at all. He's always had an injury.
I think the first two years were a bit overblown, a bit, because I think he sat out a lot more than he would have because he was young, because they were tanking, it was advantageous towards the end of the year. But they weren't fake injuries. They didn't just make stuff up.
Yeah, no.
You know.
Yeah.
But then the ACL, it's real. I think until that happened, anyone who said he was injury prone, I was like, I don't know. But now it's a legitimate concern. I do think, you know, I'm not a fucking doctor, but it does seem to be that we're at a point in the advancement of medicine in general where repairing ACLs is less fraught than it's ever been. I kind of, you know, pulling this out of my butt, it seems like we might be at a little bit of a tipping point where it's not the huge career alter that it once was, but it is very serious. I do think for the future, he's going to come back not looking great this next season when he does come back. I think long term, it doesn't have to be something that alters his ceiling too greatly, but it certainly is a legitimate cause for concern. Beyond that, I don't have any expertise in this field, so I don't want to speculate too much, but that's sort of my opinion on it. Do you have any like closing thoughts on this? Because I hate to belabor this when neither of us is really a doctor. Really a doctor,
The furthest thing from a doctor. My solution for like heartburn is like, oh, if you have baking soda, just take that. It's, you know, it's a base. it counters out the acid. Like that's my level of medical professional wisdom. Yeah, just use baking soda.
Yeah.
But I mean, the good news is it's not an Achilles. Like that's the one we know actually affects players.
Yeah.
Like DeMarcus Cousins is probably never going to be the same player again. So for example, like for an Achilles, like we do know for ACLs, like they've been better since, you know, like it's not like 1985.
Right.
But like if Porzingis blew his ACL in 1985, he's never playing basketball again.
Yeah.
So he should be better. I mean, I also don't trust like his, you know, his juiced up personal trainer.
It's cause for concern.
Like it is a cause for concern.
Yeah.
I wish he picked someone better. So, you know, I may question his judgment a bit on who he's hanging out with.
It factors in because you know, especially when we're still in this prospect phase, you're judging. I don't know if it's a character thing, but you are kind of, you're trying to judge what kind of person they are, what kind of decisions they make, because that factors into how they're going to grow. It's not great that he's picking this guy. He worked with Tom Brady, but Tom Brady's an idiot.
I'm with you.
A very talented idiot, but you know, he's a moron. So that doesn't necessarily mean that this is the right decision, but we brought it up, we talked about it. Honestly, I don't want to talk about the injury anymore. I think we got to move on. But defense, right? Is that all right?
Defense is good.
Let's talk about defense. As a defensive quarterback, which he is, as the, you know, he doesn't necessarily play center in all his minutes, but I think he plays that role on the defensive end as the anchor. And I dare say that at this very moment, not amongst us, but amongst the general NBA population, he might be underrated in this regard as a defensive anchor. Because I thought he did just a fantastic job this past season. And starting with rim protection. Just elite rim protection. And this is a theme of his. But his block rate was 3.8%. 97th percentile block rate. I think he led the league in blocks for like at least a month or two total blocks after he went down, because he had so many blocks while he was healthy. So just starting with their final line of defense, extremely pleased with the clay that he threw out onto the sculpting table this past season. What do you think about him on this end of the floor, Drew?
Rim protecting wise, I think he's he's one of the best. I'm not going to say he's the best because Anthony Davis is still in the league.
Yeah, so,
Rudy Gobert is up there. Like, there's certain players I'm not going to be like, he's the best. But instead of blocks, one of the better things to do is look at defended field goal attempts near the rim, so like within 6 feet.
Okay.
And you look at the field goal differential, and he was second in the league amongst like high volume rim protectors. And what I mean by high volume, like, you know, more than, I don't know, like 4 defended field goal attempts per game, like something like that.
Okay.
Like someone who's constantly defending the rim. And he was doing this at the power forward position mainly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So like he was 16th per game for most defended field goal attempts within 6 feet. And he was second in field goal differential. I don't remember who was at number one, because I'm actually just reading this off my Porzingis defensive article. If you haven't read that, I'm posting and posting. So a little subtle plug before the plug.
Yeah,
so definitely need that. But he is one of the best at protecting the rim, and like the statistics back it up.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to like, oh, it's not the statistics, just watch the game. Like he affects it.
It's true. And to add color to this, just to kind of add, you know, some more fuel to this fire. When you talk about on-off numbers, opponents shot almost 8% worse at the rim with him on the court than off. That's 95th percentile. The opponents shot overall, not just at the rim, but overall, a little over 3% worse their effective field goal percentage with him on the court than off. That's 91st percentile. Teams score 6 fewer points with KP on the court than off. That's per 100 possessions. That's 91st percentile. And furthermore, to kind of bolster his unicorn cred a little bit, he shows this ability both in half court and transition. You know, he's a very mobile big guy. So in half court, opponents score nearly 6 points less per 100 half court plays. So that's 90th percentile. And in transition plays, opponents score almost 2 points less per 100 transition plays. That's 90th percentile. So you know, he's defending in the half court, he's defending in transition, he's defending around the rim, he's holding the opposing team, you know, in general, he's helping this kind of domino effect of how good he is at rim protection and all these other things that he does, you know, carries across all kinds of areas on the court. I want to say something, though, about, I think you have some thoughts on Porzingis' ability to defend in space. We've established that he's a fantastic rim protector. I think he's good in the mid-range and stopping those shots, too. There's some debate about how good he is defending in space, being switched onto little guys, you know, maybe at the three-point arc. What do you think about Porzingis there?
Well, that was, the, you know, basically what my article was about. It's like the last time I wrote something, posting and posting. It's been that long. It looks like it was July 23rd. It's like, oh, man, it's like the end of August. Like, where have I been? But, yeah, so I did the whole thing on it, and I always thought it was overblown because a lot of people say Porzingis can't defend in space. He can't defend stretch fours. He can't defend, you know, people running around the perimeter. And I always thought, like, that was, like, almost hyperbolic because, like, is it just, like, the only person I've ever seen, like, really light him up who was, like, a stretch four is, like, Ryan Anderson. But the Rockets light up everyone.
Yeah,
it's inferior, but like it's only Ryan Anderson, and the Rockets light up everyone. Like James Harden, I'm pretty sure averages like 60 points against the Knicks every time they play. Like it's something crazy. So I'm like, there's no, like, if you're just basing on that. So I just went, like, I watched all the film and I was looking at like the play type data, and a lot of it was like he was fine. Like, I'm not going to say he was good because he's not like good where he's like a plus, but like when he's engaged and when he's actually trying to defend in space, he's not bad at it. Like, I don't think he's bad. I think he's above average. So, like, whatever you want to – if you want to get to the semantics of is good, the same as above average or whatever.
For now,
I thought it's like for pick and roll ball handlers, he was in the 96th percentile. For, like, handoffs, like defensive hand, like dribble handoffs, he was in the 98th percentile.
I mean,
like, his issues would be like for the roll band. For example, or spot ups. He was in the 36th and the 22nd percentile. And then you have to account for spot ups, for example. He has to chase out someone, like his man, for example, if Jared Jackson and his Cantor are defending the pick and roll, who were disasters.
Yeah.
Like that's how, like that's how his spot up numbers come. The Knicks didn't do that. Porzingis has a lot of these like great defensive numbers. Like if you look at RPM and RAPM, and like he's at all these plus minuses, he's doing that primarily playing with Jared Jack and with Enes Kanter. Like Hornacek refused to play Porzingis with Kyle O'Quinn and Frank Ntilikina, who were significantly better than those two defensively. I would also, you know, Kyle O'Quinn's also just a significantly better player than Enes Kanter too. But that's a whole, like, agreed. I don't want to get into
it. We've got into it on the podcast. I think everyone who's been listening should agree. Shame on you if you don't.
Yeah, like, I mean, if you don't agree, I just want to be like, are you even watching the games? Like, it's not even, like, the numbers probably also show this, too. But I don't want to be, like, the eye test guy, but, like, just watch the games.
Yeah,
like, how can you actually fathom that? But, yeah, like, he just didn't play with those guys, and he has all these great numbers. Like, you know, overall numbers, even playing with these guys. And I think if you match him, like, if he plays with Frank Moore, and if Mitchell Robinson actually becomes, like, as promising as he looked in summer league, those are two guys you can play with Porzingis, and Porzingis doesn't have to worry about, oh, do I still have to defend the rim? Because Enes Kanter can't defend the rim.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Enes Kanter can't play defense. Like, there's nothing he's good at with defense.
And it's
so, like,
to keep talking about, like, this 3-point thing, because this was something that bugged me earlier for most of the season, and it was tough for me to figure out what was going on, because I know he was on the floor with Kanter and Jack, and I was like, it just seemed like the opponents are, like, bombing threes when he's on the floor. Is this his fault? And I found two stats that I thought were kind of interesting that I thought ultimately gave a pretty good picture of what was going on. Now, opponents shot 6.1% more frequently from downtown when he was on the court. So that's second percentile. So I was like, I wasn't crazy when he was on the court. They were jacking more threes. But interestingly, opponents shot 5 percentage points worse from three when he was on the court than off. So the Knicks as a team did find themselves in a position where a lot more threes were being jacked up when KP was on the court. But I think part of that, like you said, was Kanter and Jack being out there and people running them in pick and rolls to death. And I think at the end of the day, that KP and the other guys who were on the court while this was happening, maybe a little Timmy, a little Courtney Lee, as much as I hate to give them credit, did actually do a decent... He wasn't so bad at, you know, like, covering in those situations as I thought. He couldn't have been because their performance was so much better from a field goal percentage against the three-pointer when he was on the court than off. So whatever was going on in my head, the results wound up being that it like wasn't the disaster that I thought it was in terms of defending the three-point line, if that rambling anecdote sort of makes sense. So
well, you also have to account for like three-point shooting like percentages stuff. They vary a lot too.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a high variance to making them and like missing them. So there's a lot of like the word is like luck. Yeah. I don't like using luck, okay, but there is a luck involved for like they make like teams are just missing more shots.
Yeah,
that okay. could be the case.
Could have just been like a 1 year sort of lucky streak while they're where they're missing all these three pointers.
Yeah, and I mean that happens, but you know, defense is such a team like it's very team oriented.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So, like if you have like two weak links, you know, at like the for example, a point of attack, which could be a basic high screen and roll. So if you have two guys who just fundamentally can't defend that action, like your entire defense is screwed. Yeah. It's something as simple as that. So like,
yeah, against a good team, you're right. You need, one weak link is pretty much the most you can deal with at a time.
Yeah, and one yeah, like but that weak link is also you need to cover it with like great defense, you know, great defensive scheme and players like the Celtics with Isaiah Thomas. You know, they also had like Al Horford, who's amazing. Like, kind of make up for that,
right?
So, like, mm-hmm. you can't have two. And outside of Porzingis, who's you know, there's Frank as like the you know the top notch defender. Everyone else is average to below average and not good. I mean, Courtney Lee's defensive metrics don't really pan out well.
No,
Tim like Hardaway's kind of pans out a little better than
he was okay. He was okay. Like,
yeah, I mean, like he's fine. Like he's not gonna kill you, but he's not gonna really like.
But like he should, anything. He should be your like weak link. You know what I mean? Like that's a good team.
Yeah, exactly.
If, yeah,
exactly. Like for the Warriors, for example, everyone's like Curry's the weak link. Like Curry's not bad.
Right. Yeah. That's, that's why they're the Warriors. But
yeah, for the Warriors. Yeah. But like just to kind of get an idea of like
yeah,
who,
sure.
like who could be your weakest link? Right. Someone like a Steph Curry, someone like a Tim Hardaway, where they're like, no, they're fine.
Yeah,
I think Steph Curry's actually. I think Steph's actually a better defender than Tim. But
I agree. But like Tim's like fine. He's okay. You know.
Yeah, like your best like the player you're playing most can't be Jarrett Jack coming off like two knee surgeries,
right?
And Enes Kanter like that. Just you're going to be bad no matter yes. what.
I want to round out. I want to round out this discussion of Kristaps's defense, and then we can. If anything fell through the cracks, please let me know. But as far as I am concerned, and this stat is for Schwinney here. Who thinks that the only thing a center should do is defensive rebound. Porzingis' defensive rebounding was in the 25th percentile this past year. So not,
which is awful.
Which is not good. He had a 14.9%, let's call it 15%, defensive rebounding rate. That's what percentage of the available rebounds he was grabbing off opponents' missed shots. So
also awful.
Poor. Poor. No, awful. Is it possible, is he doing any boxing out? Just for the sake of, you know, having this discussion, because sometimes a bigs like Robin Lopez is the real golden boy for this kind of thing. His rebounding numbers aren't great, but his team's rebounding numbers are always pretty good because he has a lot of boxing out. Do you see any of that from KP?
I think Porzingis is just an awful rebounder. Mm-hmm. Like, he's absolutely dreadful. I also think some of it has to do, and I know this sounds crazy, this almost sounds like Phil Jackson conspiracy. Like, I think Porzingis is too tall, and his center of gravity is too tall, where he's never going to be a good defensive rebounder.
Interesting. Interesting.
Like, I don't think he, like, I know, like, it sounds like he's not stocky. He's slim, he's tall, like, and he can't really put, like, he can't get his ass on someone in, like, a good position. Like, Enes Kanter can.
It's true.
Like, he's shorter, he's, like, stockier, he's beefier. Like, I don't think Porzingis is ever going to be a plus, but, like, he needs to be more fundamentally sound, like, with, like, just attempting the box out, because if he's going to play the five, he needs to be better. Now, does he need to be elite? No. He needs to be elite almost at, like, everything else in order to make up for the defensive rebounding, but, like, he needs to improve on it. I don't know how he improves on it other than maybe, you know, his trainer shooting him up with steroids. Like, I don't know how else.
No, you make a great point, because rebounding, it's weird. If you don't watch a ton of basketball, you might be like, oh, you're tall, you can grab it. but yeah, it's really not about that at all. It's about like having like a big fat ass to get more in the Phil Jackson zone and like being a wide dude and being able to hold your ground and carve out that space. It's the reason why someone like Willis Reed was just, you know, a phenomenal rebounder, even though he was a very short center. You know, it's
like, well, like Charles Barkley too. What was he? Charles Barkley is maybe 6 foot. You know what I'm saying? I'm exaggerating, but like he was not as tall as he.
I was like, wait, this Drew thing, Charles Barkley was 6 feet. I had to think for a second.
Yeah, he was. You know, Charles was 5 foot five.
Yes.
Barkley was maybe what? I think he was like 6'5". I'm not entirely sure what his actual height was.
I feel like he was more like 6'8", but let me see.
Was he? Basketball Reference isn't going to give like a.
Oh my god! I googled Barkley and Saquon came up first. That's outrageous. Shame on you, Google.
That's crazy.
6'6". 6'6" is Charles Barkley. So
okay, well, I don't know who the other guy you're talking about is.
He's a running back for the New York Giants, a rookie.
No, I couldn't care less.
As you shouldn't, which is why I'm outraged.
Yeah, like I couldn't care less. But no, okay, so like, because like Barkley was very stocky and beefy. Yes. Like that's mm-hmm. why he was a great rebounder. Like he gets into people, and that's what's more important about rebounding. I don't think there was ever a good rebounder above, I think outside of Shaq, but Shaq's like the anomaly.
Yeah.
Like, who was a great rebounder above, like, 7'1"?
What about, like a Yao Ming? Like,
was Yao Ming really good, though?
I feel like he had pretty good numbers, rebounding-wise.
I don't know if he really was. Like, mm-hmm. I don't really remember him being like this, oh my god, he's a great rebounder. Like, he was 7'5". Like, he should have averaged, like, 15, 16 rebounds or so.
Right. I'm looking at, oh man, Yao Ming, what a depressing basketball reference. He played so few seasons.
Aww. Yeah, I know. It's really upsetting.
It really is. But, okay, so his rebounds per game. This is very, you know, this is a Neanderthal stat right here, a per game stat, yeah. But I'll hit you with it. 8.2, 9.0, 8.4, 10.2, 9.4, 10.8, 9.8. So if Porzingis could get into that realm, I'd be very happy. But you're right. It's not like a dominating rebounding rate for someone that you might think who's 7'6", right?
Yeah, like I'm just saying, like tall people don't rebound well. Yeah. Like that's my theory, and I'm going with it. And if you're gonna say Shaq, I'm gonna say Shaq's the anomaly because Shaq was literally the anomaly of all basketball.
I mean, Shaq was was he the heaviest player to ever play basketball, something like that? Like
He was like not only tall, like he was just like super wide. He was super strong. He was athletic. Like Shaq doesn't really count for these things. Like everyone else, like Sean Bradley couldn't rebound. Like that, just like don't like all the time. Like Sean Bradley couldn't rebound.
And I think KP's like infinitely more solid than Sean Bradley, but he does still have some of those issues. Like he's just never going to be this like beefy load. I mean, maybe he will become. Let's say it again, a beefy load. Again, this is statistics, but I don't see him putting on that kind of muscle, that kind of heft, short of like massive steroid injections. Like you said, I do think he needs to put in better effort there, and he can improve that way, throwing a body on guys. But I don't think he has the build to ever become, you know, anywhere close to sort of elite in that regard. But I think he can get to where he needs to be in sort of a Yao Ming-ish sort of way. I mean, if he averaged 10 rebounds a game, I'd be ecstatic. I'll put it that way.
Oh, yeah. If Portland ever did 10, that would be fantastic. You know, yeah, he doesn't even throw a body on someone. Just be a little more active, which is why I'm kind of hoping, you know, knock on wood, even though I don't have any wood around. But, you know, Zion Williamson, that guy would be a great fit next to Porzingis. That guy is, you know, beefy, he's a beefy load.
He is a beefy Sean Kemp-esque load who I just want to put out the vibes that we're getting him early this time. I think I waited too long to put out Doncic vibes, but I'm putting on Zion vibes right now. I mean, so...
Yeah, I'm on the Zion train.
You're on the Zion train? Nice.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever watched. I don't even think I've watched highlights or anything. Like, I don't really know anything about like these prospects or anything. I just know that Zion's like 6'7", 285, and he's like 285, like all muscle.
Yeah,
and I'm like, that's the guy you need to put next to Porzingis. Like, I'm big on like the guys like Draymond and Julius Randle and like those guys that feel like fit next to Porzingis outside of like, you know, the elite guys like Anthony Davis or Rudy Gobert or. What's his name? LeBron James. I'm like, I can't believe I forgot LeBron. But
yeah,
that guy.
Zion is a definitional beefy load. Like, that's just watch some highlights of him because it's incredible. I mean, I don't know how good a basketball player he is yet, but his raw physical tools are ridiculous.
I think I've seen him just dunk. I think that's the only thing I've seen him do is dunk. And no one's going to take a charge from that guy.
No.
I'm telling you, like, no one. I wouldn't. I just, nope. just go ahead.
Get these guys are all freak athletes, and then you see him, and you're like, no, that's now I remember what a freak athlete is. Like that's a freak athlete.
Yeah, it's like prime. Like it's like if you go back and watch like prime LeBron James film when he's like in transition. It's like why would anyone stand in front of him? It's like
you're gonna get
the
hurt.
Dumbest thing you can do.
Yeah. You're gonna get Ron Bakered by Anthony Davis.
Yeah,
if you know
where you get injured for like
it's not worth it. It's not like your gumption just got you a broken face. I appreciate you, Ron, but you got to be a little smarter there because you're just gonna. It's not worth it. I sort of want to like wrap up. We've been going a little longer than we have lately for some of these, but I think Kristaps warrants it being, you know, as of right now, the most important player in the franchise. Are there any sort of things that you feel have slipped through the cracks of this report card so that you want to bring up? I know for me, I just want to say his overall on off was excellent. It was plus 7.6. The Knicks, even with this poo-poo platter of terribly coached bad basketball players, played like a 43-win team with him on the court, which is kind of one of the reasons that I think as soon as he gets healthy, if they have good coaching and continue to build through the draft and don't even have to add superstar players, they're going to be better sooner than I think people realize once he is healthy. Just quickly, only Nick other than Ron Baker with a positive plus-minus was Kristaps Porzingis with a plus 0.3. And he had a zero net rating. And Ron Baker was the only one who had a positive net rating. And Kuzminskas, who played, I think, a minute and a half, also had a zero net rating.
If that.
Yeah, I think he had about one play for the Knicks. So those were sort of my like catch-all stats that I haven't brought up yet. Is there anything that you feel bears mentioning before we sort of put a bow on this one?
Yeah, I think the main thing, if not anything stat-wise, is just to keep in mind that Porzingis, I would say, again, for the third year in a row, started off hot. And really tailed off.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's something we, you know, all of us need to watch moving forward if that's going to be the norm or, you know, if he can get over that through just better conditioning and better shot selection.
Right.
And whatnot. Like, that's one thing we need to, like, kind of, like, hopefully he can improve on it. Like, he did it for a third year in a row. We don't want that becoming a pattern. And, like, despite that, like, he still kind of dragged this team to be, like, competent.
Yeah.
When he was on, like when he was playing, like even when he was struggling, like into December, the Knicks were, you know, a competing 500 team. Every now and then they were above 500 with him on the court, you know, with him playing. Like he was like, he's that good. Like this team wasn't good at all. And he managed to, just by his sheer presence, made them like competent defensively when he was on the court and competent offensively. And
they were tanking a little bit at the end, you know, although not as hard as some teams, but once he went down, they played like the worst team in the league by their one loss rate. So that just shows how far he did drag them, like you said, almost by himself.
Yeah, like they dropped off again after Christmas, like they always do. The tradition, you know, the Knicks tradition for the past.
That's true.
I don't know how many years, but like he still dragged them to like a good record until Christmas time. Then they fell off and then he got injured. And then they were like truly the worst team in basketball with him not there.
Yeah.
So, like, that's how important he is. So, we just got to hopefully he becomes more consistent and healthy. But even without his consistence and health, like, he's still that good. So, I just want to just kind of end with that sort of sentiment. Like,
totally.
Keep that in mind.
Given all that, given what we've discussed, you know, this is mostly for shits and giggles. But if you wanted to give him a letter grade, what do you think the season deserves?
I think because I am taking kind of the kid's glove off a little bit because some of the criticisms. You know, like, there are some issues with, like, what he needs to do. I'm going to give him a B.
Okay.
I think a B is a fair grade.
I think that's fair.
Because he started off super hot, and if he stayed like that before he was injured, he would have got, you know, an A++++.
Right.
Like Jared Jack or whatever I gave him.
Sure.
But no, like, he tailed off, and he wasn't as consistent or whatnot. So I think a B would be fair because, you know, the tailing off and the really poor shooting efficiency numbers.
I'm pretty much with you. Just to sort of reiterate what I said at the beginning of the program, you know, for me, what was most important and forgetting the injury for a moment was just this idea of the clay. What kind of clay did he throw out there this past year? And I think he showed, you know, incredible potential as an offensive anchor. Like I said, he hasn't shown that he can facilitate on offense yet. Though he does have a degree of making his teammates better, even without that, just through his sheer gravity. You know, he really helps space the floor by who he is and how much attention has to be paid to him. He has shown that he can dominate on offense, without, you know, without that game planning going into him and double teaming. So that's very important. He's shown that he's got, you know, really great clay as a defensive anchor. I think he's got that in him to really be the guy who leads the team on defense. He's already shown that he's an elite defensive anchor. So when you put all those things together, his third year, I still think it's, you know, it's going to be hard to get there, but I don't think we've taken away the ceiling of him being the best player on a championship team. I think that's still on the table. There are some legitimate concerns, as we've mentioned, and as you, you know, just said yourself about his efficiency. I mean, his points per shot attempt were very, very low, like Bear's mentioning. But I still think he showed tremendous potential, and that's the lion's share of what you were kind of looking for this season. I was a little bit happier, but I'm still saying in the B range. I'm saying B plus for Kristaps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't, I did my exercise of starting with an A. I'm like, no, there was enough going on. Because again, if we're talking about, if Kristaps was like Alonzo Trier and all of a sudden he's doing what Kristaps is doing, you know, I'm like giving him an A quadruple plus because we didn't expect that from him. But given the kind of expectations we have for someone, it factors into, you know, how far along is he to getting there. So yeah, I feel good about Kristaps. I'm not super worried about the injury, although it's obviously concerning. I'm going to be nervous until he comes back, but overall, I think it was a nice season for him, and he did a lot of, for all the negative things, he had a lot of really great things, and I still think that people should be very excited about his future with, you know, some cautious optimism.
I think that's fair. One thing I just realized we forgot, and I think it's kind of important to note, his personal fouls declined.
Yes. Oh, yes. Thank you.
Yes, and I just wanted to point that out because I think that's a really important factor because we're talking about him being a defensive anchor.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like, in order for him to be a defensive anchor, he needed to stop fouling.
Yep.
So per 100 possessions last year, the 2016-17 season, his personal fouls was 5.6. He dropped it down to 4.5 this past year. Mm-hmm. Like, that's one less foul. And I think that's huge because that's basically from fouling out to staying late in games. Like that one foul difference.
Yeah, think about it. Think about how you play with five fouls versus how you play with four. It completely changes how aggressive you can be.
Exactly. So I think that's huge moving forward and just kind of shows you it just takes time to learn defense. And especially not just learning defense, not like perimeter defense, like anchoring the defense. It just kind of shows you like it takes a lot of time. It's, like it took a while for like DeAndre Jordan, for example, to get used to it.
Yeah.
Rudy Gobert has improved year over year. Hell, Kyle O'Quinn has improved every single year he was with the Knicks. And he, you know, we're talking about someone who was in his, you know, mid-20s when he joined. And he also improved year over year.
True.
Defensively. Like, it takes a while. So just, like, that's another sign to look forward to. Like, if he continues with him, stopped fouling, which he did. He stopped reaching. He stopped, like, slapping at the ball.
Yeah.
He stopped going after every single block. Like, he was just a much better defender. So I just want to point
you
that out.
Thank you very much for pointing that out, because that was, again, you're looking to improve, and he improved in so many areas, and that was one of them. And that's one of the reasons, this is like a small thing, but why I'm a little bit more hopeful, I would say, than you about his ability to sort of read the offense better is that he is in that position where he's reading the defense. You know, he's reading the other team's offense as sort of like the quarterback of the defense and reading the whole court in that way. And it's a different skill. You don't have the ball in your hand. You're not dribbling and thinking about shooting. And I think it's harder to read the defense as like the focal point of the offense. But it gives me like a little bit, you know, it ups my belief maybe a couple percentage points. The fact that he's able to kind of take in all that information on defense and sort of read what the opposition's doing. It's not, you know, the be all end all, but it factors into it.
Well, to be a little more positive on that note, I think we should kind of consider that Porzingis did improve a number of little areas year over year. Like we mentioned last year, he needed to improve posting up smaller defenders.
Yeah.
He did that. He needed to improve on his fouling. He did that. Like there's things that he did. He needed to work on his three-point shooting efficiency.
Right.
He did that. Like, he did all these things. And the good news is this was his first year as the focal point, and he did a poor job of it. So I would like to see how he does the next full year he's playing, not next. If he comes back like after the All-Star break, it's almost like a wash. Like, it's almost like, can you run? Like,
I agree completely.
Like, can you run? Can you jump? Can you do these things? And I'll be like, all right, if he does that, it's fine. So it'll be like, I would say the following year or whatever. I want to see how he improves passing wise. But what I was actually leading up to saying is usually like the outliers and the greats kind of overcome these things and they are able to improve.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's so many different facets. Like, the greats do that, and Porzingis does seem someone like kind of like an outlier for what he can do. Like, he's already the 7'3" guy who could run shoot, dribble, play defense. Like, he could do all these things. So yes, he could be that outlier where he can improve. He could jump to, like, being average at passing out of double teams. Like, a lot of the great players do. Like, we see Giannis, someone who, you know, was awful his first year and now is, you know, is he the best player in the East right now, Giannis? Yeah. Probably.
And I also think that he's the kind of guy, I think he's the kind of guy who recognizes when he's bad at something and actively wants to improve it and works at improving it. Like, I think that's part of his mindset.
No, I agree. And he did that. Like,
yeah,
everyone was saying, like, he's awful at posting smaller guys. So he did it. He's competent now. Like, he's not, like, elite at it, but, like, he's fine now. Like, yeah, before he was awful.
Yeah. And the reality is that you can't improve on everything at once as much as these guys say, like, I'm working on everything. You can't. But yeah, okay. I feel great about this episode. I feel great about Chris Depp's future, is what I wanted to say. Also, why don't you let the people know, Drew, where they can find you online if you want to be even more overt with some plugs right now. Now's the time to do it.
Well, online, you could find me writing stuff at either posting and toasting or Nylon Calculus if Fansided doesn't kick me out for inactivity. So we'll see about that. So either of the two, I am, now that I'm settled with my semi-cross-country move, I should be will be working on more things for both places. I do have some interesting stuff about trying to create a play type plus minus stat, which should be a little fun.
I love that.
For, you know, for the stat nerds,
yeah,
out there. I'm trying to think if there's anything else to plug. I mean, in person, you could probably find me wandering around Boston now.
Yeah, he's moved into enemy territory, guys.
I've moved into enemy territory, so if you want to, you know, online, you know, Scooter Toots on Twitter.
Scooter Toots.
In person, Mission Hill, Boston. Just wandering around eating donuts.
He'll be the guy getting yelled at by old women for having a girl's haircut.
Yes, and James is actually referencing something that actually happened to me. So, like I said, you'll see me wandering around with donuts and girl hair in Boston.
But, what was the give him that story quickly. What exactly happened with the woman?
Yeah, so I decided to find a new yoga practice because I need to start being healthier, because I'm afraid when I'm like 40 I can't like walk.
Uh-huh.
So like I'm trying to like be more active in something like yoga makes more sense. Plus it's also been helping me with like my tension headaches. Anyway, that's not the point. So I'm walking back from yoga and there's like this old bitter looking like white lady who's on like the third or second story of like a three family or two family home.
Uh-huh.
And I have my hair pushed back in like a headband because it's yoga. You gotta have your hair back because otherwise it's in your face and it's a nightmare.
Sure.
And she's just yelling out, it's like, that's girl's hair. You have girl's hair. And
did she have a thick Boston accent?
No, it's just one of those like old lady accent. You know, like old lady sound.
Like they're
it's
about
like a
to
typical
die.
Like, yeah, exactly. And she's like, she was very angry and she's not really bitter.
Yeah.
I thought it was hilarious because like, you're that, like, you're going out of your way to say that to some random person walking in the street. Like, it's a problem. Yeah. I thought it was hysterical. But if she ever says it again, I'm probably going to snap at her. Because, like,
that's gender normative bullshit.
Yeah, like, something like that. Because, like, after my yoga practice, I'm relaxed.
Yeah.
I'm in my meditative state. I'm calm.
You've been breathing.
So, like,
you know?
I've been breathing well. Like, I don't want to deal with someone, like, insulting my hair. Like, I found it funny the first time. If it happens again, I'm going to snap.
Yeah.
And by snapping, it's going to be like, you know, shut up. Like, I'm not really going to, like, I'm not going to go off. I'm not, like, that type of person. I think I've only exploded once at someone, and it was because of a car accident that guy caused. Okay. And I lost it.
Yeah, I can vouch. Drew's a real sweetie pie, and that's all we have on this show. Nothing but sweetie pies. Sometimes I include myself in that, but not always.
And Sweeney pies.
There you go. Drew, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, James.
All right. There we go. That's it. That's it for this year's report cards. I feel accomplished. Do you guys? We got a great episode lined up for you tomorrow. We're going to look toward the future a little bit, and we're joined by Mike Vorkunov of The Athletic. I love his work. I'm excited to talk to him. I think it's going to be a great sode. But this sode is ending, so I just want to say thank you so much for listening. If you've got a moment, rate us on iTunes, please. Subscribe to the show. This is also very important if you have not already. And furthermore, we want to grow our audience, so if you like it, tell people that you think would like it about the show. follow us on Twitter at Locked On Knicks for bonus takes and general camaraderie. Or you can follow me at NBA Injury Report for jokes and jokes and jokes about basketball. Be chill to each other. Spay and neuter your pets. If it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down. Always salt the pasta water. Take that, take that, take that for data. Biggie's the best rapper of all time. Peace!